Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. My producer, as always, is Lou Pellegrino. Coming up on today's podcast, we are featuring two members of The Athletic, the new premium subscription sports service. First up is Stuart Mandel. He's the editor-in-chief of The All-American. That is their new college football site. He's also the co-host of The Audible. And Seth Davis, who will be the managing editor of The Fieldhouse. That will be The Athletic's college basketball site. We will talk about what their philosophy is in terms of editing, in terms of staffing. How will they judge success? How will they get people to invest their time and money, most importantly, in these national verticals on college basketball and college football? Also part of our conversation, Stu talks about not having his contract renewed at Fox Sports and being part, or at least learning about, that meeting where his or the big boss there ultimately said that they were not going to use writers anymore and that the site was going to pivot to just Fox Sports personalities' takes on the news of the day. That is when Stu knew that his job was basically over. And one of the issues we'll get into with Seth Davis, of course, one of the most politically active people in the sports media space on social media. I will ask him about his decision to do that, and does he ever worry that by delving into sports, he can either hurt himself with his employer or with potential people who would buy The Athletic. So Stu Mandel and Seth Davis coming up on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Okay, and as we noted at the top, I bring in Stuart Mandel. He is the editor-in-chief of The All-American. And if you do not know what The All-American is, and Stu will certainly tell you on this podcast, it is the premium subscription college football site as part of The Athletic. We have had other Athletic people on this podcast, including Tim Kawakami. And Stuart Mandel is running their college football premium sub service. Stu also co-hosts a podcast with Bruce Feldman of Sports Illustrated and Fox Sports. That is called The Audible. Check that out. And Stu is a former senior writer at Fox Sports and Sports Illustrated, and he joins us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Stu, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Richard. I guess we're not four or five doors down like we once were, but happy to talk with you here over the phone.
I know. I'm so formal on the intro, Stu, even though I know you. All right, let's first start off with, you know, I talked to Kawakami on this podcast, and he gave listeners a pretty good breakdown of The Athletic. What I think a lot of people, at least at this point, don't know is what you and Seth Davis are going to do with these kind of verticals within The Athletic. So can you just, let's just start from the beginning. Give people a sense of what the All-American is going to be or what you hope it will be.
Well, as you said, The Athletic started with the local sites like the Chicago site, the Cleveland site. Now, obviously, Tim's doing the site in the Bay Area. The founders of The Athletic saw an opportunity this year. I mean, it's been such a brutal year in our industry with so many high-profile national writers being free agents that they saw an opportunity here to move into the national space. And what we want The All-American to be is a definitive stop for all diehard college football fans, people who, you know, don't consider college football secondary to the NBA or the NFL. You know, there are millions of people out there, whether they're in Nebraska or they're Ohio State fans or they're Alabama fans. This is their first love. And so the idea that we've put together, including myself, seven writers who are dedicated year-round to nothing but national college football, who all have connections and relationships across the sport, is a really, truly unique concept and one that I think fans out there are you know, craving. And, you know, it's on us to obviously do good work that's worth paying for and to distinguish ourselves with unique stories that aren't already being told, you know, a million different ways from other media outlets. But I like the collection of writers that we have, and obviously the, you know, the reaction so far has been very, very positive.
All right, Stu, can you give people a sense of how you look at a publishing schedule? Like, should there be a certain number of stories that get published per day? Will you publish on the weekend? Obviously, Saturday is a very important college football day. So for even though things obviously will change and stories are fluid, what is your general blueprint on a publishing schedule?
You know, we're going to try to find that sweet spot. And to start out, I mean, first of all, in season, it's certainly going to be a 7-day-a-week site. You know, we've started out here with about 5 to 7 new stories a day, at least that we have planned. And then, you know, news breaks, you may have to add more to that. You know, it's a site that reacts in real time to college football news. And so it's interesting because this first week, you know, we've been planning for this for 2 months now. So it is a lot of stories that people that our writers went around the country in August to various training camps and are able to prepare ahead of time. Dan Uthman is my managing editor, and he and I joke that for all the planning that went into this week, you know, what happens on Sunday after they've actually played some games and we have to actually come up with some things from scratch. But, you know, at that point, I think we'll really be into the flow of things in terms of, okay, you know, based on what we're the feedback we're getting from the subscribers, what is that sweet spot of stories that is enough for you to feel like you're getting your money's worth and not so much that we're flooding you with more stories than you can possibly read in a day? Because I do think in a subscription site, people are going to be interested in reading, you know, most, if not all, of the content that we produce in a given day.
How did you go about staffing? What was your staffing philosophy?
It was a truly interesting challenge, Richard, because, you know, I went in a very short time from being a writer myself, who was, you know, interviewing for jobs for various times, to being the one who hires the writers. And so Dan Uthman and I think we had a bit of a leg up in that we, you know, even when we were still at Fox and USA Today, would talk from time to time about, hey, how cool would it be to start a national college football site? And hand in hand with that goes, what kind of staff would you want to put together? So the staff that we ended up putting together, it was very, we paid a lot of attention to, obviously, you want to get extremely talented people and people who know the sport, but you also don't want to get six or seven people who all do exactly the same thing. I mean, I'm very proud of the fact that we have people with truly unique voices. You know, you saw Chantel Jennings with her oral history of Jim Harbaugh's appearance on Saved by the Bell. That is a very unique story that I wouldn't want anybody else to tell. And then we have other writers who have a particular fondness for recruiting or a particular fondness for data and analytics, who are, you know, very good at analysis and instant reaction to the news. So it was a key thing there to make sure everybody has their own individual niche, even though everybody will obviously be doing a little bit of everything. And then obviously we wanted to have the whole country covered, and it just kind of worked out in the end. I mean, we didn't necessarily think it would be this perfect, but we have somebody in Portland with Chantel. I'm in California. Max Olson and Chris Vanini are in Texas. Matt Fortuna is in Chicago, and Nicole Auerbach's in New York. And Jason Kersey is our SEC person in Arkansas. So we really do have the whole country covered.
All right, a couple things on that. How important is breaking news going to be, especially in terms of getting the site some attention versus analysis, commentary, feature stories?
Well, we want to break news because of what you just said. It helps build the site's credibility. Obviously, if we can have the All-American Report scrolling across the ESPN ticker, that helps get out brand awareness. But the interesting thing with a subscription site is, you can't put, you can't, once that news actual scoop is out on Twitter, it's out there for the world. You know, you can't necessarily say, sign up for a subscription, come read this story that we just broke, because by then everybody else will have tweeted it and aggregated it and whatnot. So to your point, you know, we've told our people, obviously we want to break news, but if it is somebody else breaking the story, you need to immediately go into analysis, reaction mode. I've done that for most of my career as a columnist, and I think it'll be cool because while everybody is national, everybody on the staff has a point conference. Chantel has been covering the Pac-12 for ESPN.com. Jason's came from SEC Country, et cetera. So, you know, something happens in the Pac-12. Chantel, you're the go-to. Tell us, put this into perspective. You know, Matt covered Notre Dame. If Brian Kelly gets fired this year, there's nobody I would trust more to write the definitive column about what went wrong for Brian Kelly. So that, to me, is where we're really gonna have to stand out. We're gonna have to have truly informed and connected analysis.
One of the things that I know you saw over the last couple days, where you took some criticism and you should address it, is the lack of diversity right now on the staff. There is no person of color currently working under you. One, what is your reaction to that criticism? And two, will that change, and will that change soon?
Well, the criticism, obviously, you know, it was tough to see that, especially on the first day that you launched. But I also totally understand it. I totally get where there would be criticism. The fact is, we're still, you know, I mean, we're starting with a very small staff. And like any business, you know, you hope you have success, and if you're able to grow, pretty rapidly and expand. And certainly, as we do that, increasing diversity of the staff is going to be hugely on the top of our minds. I mean, it already is, or it already was, as we were going through that process to hire the original staff. I will say, Richard, that, you know, I've been covering college football and going to press boxes on Saturdays for 18 years, and it's just an unfortunate reality that these, you know, for these college press boxes are unfortunately some of the least diverse places you can imagine. It's just not, it's a problem that we have in this beat in general. And I covered the NBA finals with the Warriors a couple years ago, and I really saw, wow, the NBA media is just so far ahead of college football in that regard. And so I mentioned earlier, you know, making that transition from writer to person who hires writers, you really feel that the burden of the responsibility to, hey, you know, I actually have a chance to help change this now. And that's something I want to embrace. We didn't necessarily have the chance, or didn't necessarily work out that way with this initial group of writers. But hopefully, like I said at the beginning, we have success, we expand, and, you know, get a chance to do that pretty soon.
Why do you think that is? And maybe this is not the right discussion for two white guys to be having, but why do you, I don't cover college football, so I'm not in press boxes. I can't tell you the demographics firsthand. Obviously, anecdotally, I got a pretty good sense that a lot of the people who cover the sport are white males, even more than white females. Why do you think that is? Do you have any thoughts as to why? I can understand that, why that was the case in 1950, 1960, Southern sport. Most of the people in the press box were white. But it's 2017, and I am surprised that the demos of that haven't changed the way they clearly have in the NBA and some other sports. Do you have any kind of thought process as to why that is?
And to be clear, there are people of color covering college football. I don't want to make it seem like, oh, there's nobody. I mean, there is. It's just not nearly the you know, the representation or the percentage that you would want it to be. I don't have a good theory for you on why it is college football specifically. You know, I will say it's got to start, obviously, at, you know, at the college level. You know, and I've talked to, I have friends who teach journalism and specifically teach sports journalism, and I've asked them, you know, what does it, you know, what kind of racial diversity do you have in your classes? Because this is where it starts with people getting into the profession. And they say it's not good, you know, it's, and so if that's the case, if it's starting that young, then how do we get from that to not just, you know, more people of color getting into sports writing in general, but then obviously which sport they end up gravitating to? And some of that is not in people's control. Or if you go get a job at a newspaper, they tell you you're going to be covering this. You don't necessarily get to pick which one. And I understand that. But, you know, I find that the people who are truly into college football find a way to cover college football for a living. And I don't have a good explanation for why the, you know, composition is what it is. I just hope we can play a role in changing it. I've certainly seen the change where we went from, you know, going into a press box in 1999 and it was all guys, it was all male, to seeing more and more women represented in that press box. We're certainly proud of the fact that, you know, we hired six writers and two of them are women. That's a higher percentage, I think, than a lot of staffs out there. So I'm happy about the progress I'm seeing there, although there is still a lot more to be done. But yeah, we've got, without question, a real diversity problem on the college football beat.
One of the things that when I said you were going to be on, a lot of people asked about, and I thought this was a pretty smart question by some readers, and that is, how do you convince people from places that are not necessarily heavy college football or not from the areas that the Athletic is already in, so the Clevelands and the Chicagos and the Torontos, how do you convince them to sign up for your college product?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, in terms of why you should subscribe to a national product as opposed to a local product, you know, this sport has become more and more national in the time that I've been covering it, and now with the playoff just dominating the conversation in college football, I mean, whoever you're a fan of, you're still interested in what's going on in the rest of the country and how it impacts the playoff race, the Heisman race. I've been found increasingly lately people are obsessed with the coaching carousel, regardless of whether it affects their own school. So there's plenty of fodder, if you will, for national college football coverage. Why it should be our product in particular, part of it is what I was telling you before about the unique stories and just the you know, I feel like it's just such a great collection of writers. But you can't tell the story of The Athletic without also telling what is not there. And I've found overwhelmingly the selling point that's resonating the most is that it's written content with no video, no autoplay videos, no pop-ups. It's smart content. It's not clickbait. It's not listicles. And it just kind of gets to the frustration that everybody is having right now with the state that the internet has gone. And it's impacted all the major sites. I think unfortunately just accepted in many ways, like, oh, of course we have to go through all these miserable intrusions to be able to read, a list of the top coaching candidates or bowl projections or whatnot. And, once you start reading The Athletic, you realize, wait a minute, it doesn't have to be this way. This is a very well-designed, very clean reading experience without all of that clutter. And I'm finding that that's one of the reasons people, or one of the main reasons, frankly, that people are signing up. We're giving them good journalism, but we're also not giving them the stuff that is just becoming more and more maddening for people who spend a lot of time on the internet.
This is one of the questions I talked to Tim. This is a question I sort of discuss and talk about with so many people, because to me, this is the whole ballgame, Stu. And I'm not expecting you to have the answer. I just want to discuss it with you. And that is this. For so many years, people, particularly under the age of 30, have gotten content free. They've been raised and grown up in a world where sports content is free, either on ESPN.com or elsewhere. Now, I understand some people will pay for The Insider and Sports Illustrated, but as a philosophical concept, sports information is free. So to me, the only way The Athletic succeeds is to change behaviors into convincing people that something that they've had for free for a long time is worth it, given that the quality that you're going to produce. Have you thought about just what it's going to take to convince people to change their information gathering behavior that they've had their whole life, which is, generally speaking, content is free on the web?
You know, I may be naive about this, but I don't think that's necessarily the case. I mean, we, about a month or so ago, had a summit in San Francisco at the Athletic headquarters. Seth came in for, and both of our former boss, Paul Fichtenbaum, came in for, and Dan Uthman, and they showed us a slide of the demographics of the Athletic's readership, and by far the highest percentage of readers was 25 to 34. So I think it's a bit of a, you know, I understand why people think that, oh, young people aren't going to pay for content, but it's not accurate, at least in our model. But also in general, I actually think the younger audience is more conditioned to just paying for things they like, whether it's Spotify or obviously Netflix, HBO Go. There's just more of a acceptance of, oh, you like something, you pay for it. And maybe that hasn't necessarily been the case to this point with sports content, but it makes sense. I mean, I think the real mystery is why 20 years ago did the leaders of these, you know, media organizations, including the ones I've worked for, decide that it would be a good idea to give away their content for free.
Right.
I mean, it's just not, we don't do that any other walk of life. If you like a pair of jeans, you pay for it. If you like a movie, you pay for it. You know, it's frankly stunning that we spent as long as we did giving away this product that is, by the way, very expensive to do, to send people out to, as we did this August, send people out to Clemson and Florida State, Ole Miss and whatnot, to report these stories. So the sentiment I'm getting, or the reaction I'm getting so far, is that, and I think it's a direct response to what happened at several major sites this summer, is that an acknowledgement that, yes, you know what, we get it. This is valuable stuff. This is premium stuff. And for $3.99 a month, which is what our promotional rate is, normally $4.99 a month, yes, that's worth it to me to be able to keep being able to read these writers who, in a lot of cases, didn't have a place to write not that long ago.
That's a good answer. I would say continue to push that answer when people ask you the question, because I think that's sort of the right construct. Another question that I thought was pretty interesting too. One of the things obviously that's really attractive about The Athletic is that the interface is clean. There's not autoplay videos that pop up. But we do live in a world now, of course, where a lot of people do watch video. I think it's a little overstated in terms of the video climate now, because obviously that's where the ad dollars are going. But has Has The Athletic, and specifically what you're going to do, Stu, does video or will video play some kind of role, whether it's video stand-ups from you guys, whether it's video podcasts, whether it's something else?
Not in the short term. You know, I think we're focusing almost entirely on the written content and also podcasts. There will be a, you know, I do the Audible with Bruce, but also there's going to be an All-American podcast. If we end up doing video, it's going to be good video. And what I mean by that is there are many, many ways that you can incorporate video into written content in a way that, you know, enhances the product. But it's very expensive to do. It's highly produced. You know, it's often, or at least I think it should be, unique, where you're embedded with somebody maybe, that nobody else can get that video. Unfortunately, what a lot of these publishers are doing is they're, I don't know, reading some sort of market analysis or just looking at ad rates and saying, oh, we got to have video. We got to have video. We got to put video on every story, and not paying any attention to the quality of that video.
Right.
People are turned off if it looks amateurish or if it's, you know, somebody on their home Skype computer talking about a story, talking about the story that you're already reading. If we're going to do video, it's got to be a value add. It can't just be doing video just to do video, because I just, as a consumer myself, and obviously engaging with readers every single day on Twitter, I just don't think that's what they want.
What are your bosses telling you about success? What is the success? I understand what the metric of success is for some of these city sites. There's a specific subscriber number that they have to hit, and they have to obviously keep those subscribers around, and they have to, the subscribers have to keep paying. What have they, you know, you're not going to obviously give proprietary numbers, but what have your bosses told you about how they will deem success?
Yeah, I mean, they've given us a projection for year one, and you know, all I can say is it's very attainable. You know, it's not, they don't have, they're in it for the long haul. There is not this any sort of notion that, you know, you got to get to X amount by in the next 3 months or the next 6 months or this thing's a failure. They realize that we are, as you said, introducing something completely new to the public, and that there's going to take a while for acceptance. So the goal that we've set for year one is frankly very attainable, and I certainly think we can break it. And then we go from there. I think one of the cool things about this model is it's not dependent on these, you know, tens of millions of, you know, the numbers you see when you're associated with page views is just so astronomical, and everybody's just doing whatever they can to get to that, you know, unbelievable number. The number of subscribers it takes for it to be a successful site is a much more reasonable amount of people. And as long as those people are enjoying the content and are engaged, and if you look at the comment section so far in our articles, I joke to somebody, it's the nicest comment section on the internet. People seem to be generally appreciative and feel like they're part of a community. You know, so far they've had great success at retaining these readers from 1 year to the next. The retention rate is very, very high. And so as long as we can continue to give them the kind of stories they want, and also I should just say, we have a plan of what we think are the stories they want. We will find out very quickly, oh, you know what, they actually want more of this, or they want less of that, and we will obviously adjust accordingly.
How are you still looking in terms of a career arc on this? Have they, do you feel like they've given you multiple years to make this work, or do you feel, I'm not going to ask you how long your contract is, but do you feel like if this doesn't work after 12 months, I might have to look elsewhere? Like, do you have any kind of projection in your own mind in terms of how long you have as the editor-in-chief to make this work?
I think I have a long time. You know, the founders, Alex and Adam, have a vision for this company, not just for our site, but for this whole company that, you know, goes very, very far into the future. I mean, it's interesting. You know, I think one of the reasons The Athletic has taken off like it has, and frankly has kind of turned our industry on its head a little bit, is that these guys, Alex and Adam, did not come from the sports media world. They came from the tech world. They had a perspective that maybe when you're in it every day, you don't necessarily have. And because of that, they approach it the same way that a lot of tech startups do, of kind of looking at the long game. We're not chasing, next month or necessarily the month after that. We're chasing long-term success. So I've got no indication other than we're in this for the long haul, we're behind you. They have certainly given me all the resources that I could ask for to make it successful. So, you know, I have nothing but good things to say about that.
All right. Before we move on to your experience at Fox, I do want to ask you, because Seth is sort of a little bit behind you in terms of the launch of his site, but are there some findings that you found already that you would pass on to him as he makes his way close to the formal debut of the Fieldhouse?
I told him he should plan now for the sleep deprivation that's going to be coming in the week that leads up to the launch of his site. And he is fortunate in that way that he gets to kind of see us go through this first. I will definitely be talking with him, you know, if not by the end of this week, early next week. But frankly, Richard, we're talking on the second day of the launch, and I think a lot of those things we're still going to find out. You know, this is still very, very new, and we're frankly learning more things about reading patterns and the way we distribute the content as we speak. So I'm a little envious of him in that he has longer to ramp up. But I also think it's pretty cool that when we launched week one of the season. You know, we came in right at the peak time when there's peak interest in college football and kind of hit the ground running.
All right, let's talk about Fox, Stu, because this is you're an interesting person to talk to about this, because you were brought on to Fox Sports as a significant college football hire, significant college football voice. And you both wrote a lot for that site and then obviously did some television work. I think you went there under this presumption, and smartly, I would think, that this is essentially ESPN's biggest competitor when it comes to money and resources. They have this massive college football schedule, including this year, which is their best ever. So this is the kind of job that's just not a one-year job, but could potentially be a 25-year job, because they are seriously committed to college football and seriously committed to what I do. Then everything changes. So I want to sort of start from the beginning, if you could. When did you get the sense, or when did you know, that your time there was eventually going to be up and that your contract as a college football writer, college football voice, was not going to be renewed?
Well, the first 2.5 years at Fox, Richard, I mean, I got nothing but it was phenomenal, and I worked with so many great people, and you know, I wouldn't trade that time for anything. That first year, like you said, I mean, when FS1 was still a very robust news organization, where, you know, and frankly, it was, when I went there, it was with the understanding that I would write just like I always have, and I would pitch in a little bit on the TV front. And no, it was, you're a TV reporter already. You're going to, you know, I spent a week at Notre Dame doing stand-ups leading up to the Florida State game, and you know, we broadcast live from the field after the national championship game. And so I just kind of thought, oh, I guess that's how it's going to be out here. That's really cool. And then that just kind of all went away pretty abruptly after the first year. So, but even after that, there were still a lot of good TV opportunities. The part of the company that never changed in the entire time I was there is the event side, the people who put on the pregame, halftime, postgame shows that you see Rob Stone host, that you see Kevin Burkhardt host in college basketball. You know, that was a constant threat that never changed. To get to what you were asking, I mean, I realized my time was going to run out the day in early January of this year, and I wrote this in my welcome letter to the All-American when Jamie Horowitz came into the Office of Digital, because he had recently kind of taken control of that, and did a presentation to the staff that basically laid out exactly what ended up happening. We're not going to do written content anymore. We're just going to do videos promoting our personalities. And so, I mean, it was a very surreal thing. I knew in that instant, I'm gonna have to find a new place to go write.
All right, hold on 1 second, Stu. I want to stop you here because it's important. Can you take us inside that room and give us a sense of the presentation? So here's Jamie Horowitz, for people who don't know, is the head of Fox Sports Networks. He's essentially in charge of FS1 programming and FS2. He eventually gets the digital job. So he comes into a room filled with people who have worked on the digital side, writers, editors, on-air people, video people, producers, etc. Comes in and basically says that what we've been doing for a long time, I'm blowing up, and the site is now going to become essentially an inventory or a warehouse for our on-air people are on our people's takes, and that is ultimately what the site is. An all-video site with Skip Bayless, Shannon Sharp, Colin Cowherd's takes on the sports news of the day. So can you take us inside of that room and what he specifically said, and what, if you can, after that meeting, the reaction was of the people in that room?
So to be clear, I wasn't in the room. I live up here in the Bay Area, and you know the site is based in L.A., so I wasn't inside the room. I actually didn't know it was taking place until somebody texted me about halfway through and said it was, because it was being streamed. I just hadn't gotten the memo, I guess. You really need to be watching this. So, you know, I did, and then I was able to watch it, you know, in full right afterward. And then, of course, obviously, I've talked to so many people after the fact. You'll never see a room full of people more shell-shocked than that room was that day, because, you know, obviously at that point, Jamie had established his philosophy for TV pretty obviously, and that was no secret. And when he, you know, when it was announced, and frankly kind of quietly, that digital was going to fall under him when Pete, who hired me, Pete Blastelica, left, you know, we figured that was going to mean more of those kind of videos on the site. But I would never have imagined he would give one, you know, thought to the written content, because he's not from that world. He's from the TV world. So, you know, the slideshow he did, and he spoke so confidently and so kind of nonchalantly, almost as if, well, of course, this is what you guys would want to do instead. Like, there's not like selling us on it. Like, you know, just kind of, this is what we're going to do, and of course you're going to want more Colin Cowherd. You're going to want Shannon Sharp talking about Conor McGregor. But what was really just amazing that he would have the audacity to do this is you've got, like you said, the actual writers of the article sitting in this room, and he puts up a slide of a story we did when Mark Helfrich was fired from Oregon, and it was, you know, a story we did that night, 10 candidates to replace Mark Helfrich at Oregon, and the writer of that article was sitting in the room. And he goes, we're not going to do this anymore. And the very next slide was the same exact story, but now the headline is Colin Cowherd's 10 candidates to replace Mark Helfrich at Oregon. And when I say, like, I knew in an instant, my time there was probably running low, it was that instant. I hadn't written that particular article, but it, you know, very easily could have been Bruce Feldman's 10 candidates or my 10 candidates. So in the months that followed, I think some people thought, oh, the, you know, it's not going to be that extreme, or you know, we'll be able to talk him out of it, or you know, he that was a preliminary thing. But no, I mean, Jamie is very resolute in what his vision obviously was for what FS1 should be. So, you know, if that's what he wanted the vision to be for digital, then it seemed pretty clear to me that's what was going to happen.
One of the, I think, a question, Stu, that comes up is that, you know, there are other people, obviously, who have followed this idea. Maybe not as dramatic, because maybe dramatic is not the right word. You know, like, there are other places, obviously, that have, quote unquote, pivoted to video. It's a different pivot because they didn't necessarily go to their personalities' takes as the video strategy. But, you know, maybe all of us who care about the written word and care about journalism and care about, maybe we're wrong and maybe Horowitz is right. And maybe ultimately it's certainly the right strategy for cost savings. Jamie Horowitz got rid of 25, 30 people. Those are millions of dollars in cost savings. You can make the argument it's the right strategy in terms of if you want a marketing play, you're marketing essentially just your own people. You're keeping it in-house. Here's where I think, though, all these guys are, if I can say, full of shit. Where it's not the right play is, why is that site now attractive to anyone except someone who's a diehard member of the Skip Bayless fan club? And that's where I think you've destroyed your website. Where do you see this in terms of, let's play devil's advocate? Is there a strategy there? Maybe this is the future.
I think that, you know, I can't speak to other sites that have gone to that strategy. I don't, you know, I'm not there. I don't know what the thinking is behind that. I think it's important to note this is a very unique situation. This was not as far as I can tell, it wasn't like the whole company of Fox Sports came together and decided this is the way to do it. It was one person, and he wasn't doing it in terms of, with any, as far as I can tell, thought to what's best for the digital audience. It was solely seeing kind of an opportunity to, and I don't know what the budget of Fox Sports digitally operating budget is, but whatever it is, he saw it and said, oh, I have access to this now. I can use this to market my TV shows. Like, that was, it was solely about that. It wasn't about, you know, this is a better digital strategy than what we're doing now. in terms of what's best for the audience. I don't think there was any regard for the audience. So it's hard to extrapolate that and come up with any sort of, what does that mean for the larger industry? I mean, I think in general, a lot of these publishers are feeling the pressure and the crunch of the ad revenue shrinking, or the advertisers not necessarily putting any value anymore on banner ads. And so they're scrambling to come up with alternatives. And in some cases, you know, they're deciding that that all video approach is the way it is. I think that bubble is going to pop. And frankly, that's scary because you're already having, you know, ESPN lay off 100 people or various other outlets laying off people. And that's with the money that they're getting, apparently, from these videos. At
right.
some point, advertisers themselves are going to realize we're not getting any return for this because people aren't watching them. If you have to force somebody to watch it, you have to literally autoplay it so that somebody will watch it, that's probably not a sign that the audience wants it. You know, they actually want to watch these. So, and that's what I love about The Athletic is we're acknowledging that people want written content. It's not that they don't want to watch videos. They just don't want that thing blaring at them when they turn on their computer. So I guess I got away from what
you said. No. Your take is, first of all, I agree with you. I think it was a decision made by an individual who's trying to solidify his power. I think it was incredibly cynical to the larger profession as a whole. I think it was incredibly short-sighted as I've reported, and I'm sure both of us could probably use our sources to get traffic at that site is monumentally down. So in terms of a traffic play, it's been a catastrophe. In terms of a cost savings play, it's probably been very healthy, you know, in terms of on the bottom line.
And the real shame of it, Richard, is that, you know, I still hold a lot of affinity for Fox Sports as a company. They were so great to me for those 3 years, and they do, and I'm sure you agree, a phenomenal job of showing people sports.
Definitely. When they're at their best, they're fantastic. I agree with that. Let's be specific because we can probably get into their sports shows. Talking about their remote production, their game production, when they are right. at their best on stuff, they do an exceptional job. I agree.
And everybody involved in that I worked with, I mean, I learned so much about the TV industry from the people I worked with there. You know, Kent Camara, Bardi Reyes, they were my kind of mentors on the studio side of things. They do a great job with that as well. And so this is a long way of saying that the shame of what Jamie did with digital is that it made Fox Sports, which has so much to offer as a brand, irrelevant in the digital space. Everybody spends every day on the internet and reading sports content. And, you know, ESPN.com contributes to that conversation. Sports Illustrated contributes to that conversation. And Deadspin, you name it. Now, obviously, The Athletic. And Fox Sports is no longer a part of that conversation. And it's a shame because they've still got Bruce Feldman right there with the finest college, I know I'm biased, but one of the finest college football reporters out there. They still got Ken Rosenthal. Ken Rosenthal comes to The Athletic because he doesn't have anywhere to write for Fox. It's just such a shame that they, you know, forcefully removed themselves from that entire part of the media world.
I want to ask you one last question about Fox, and that's, Stu, that you worked with a lot of people and appeared on a lot of the shows now of the opinionists there. I think if I'm correct about this, you're friends with some of them away from the camera. That's all hard. A lot of times, very hard for me. It's my own sort of fault to separate.
You're talking about one person.
Yeah, correct. Separating the on-air to the off-the-air. But I'm not asking about anybody specific. I want to ask you about philosophically. That's sort of why I brought it up that way. And that is, you look at the industry now, and there are great rewards for being provocative and giving opinion, and not just at FS1 or Fox Sports Radio, but quite frankly, throughout the industry. Now, there are nowhere near as many of those jobs, obviously, as kind of the rank and file in the day-to-day. But, you know, you do wonder what the message is being sent to the public, and maybe even beyond the public, what's the message being sent to young people who want to get into the field? Do you see a happy medium where both of these realities can exist, or you know, provocateur, strong opinions, even sort of bullshit opinions that are just looking to drive traffic, as well as what traditionally has been sports journalism, or ultimately are we leading to one place where it's going to be, you know, the death of one and and one living or something else? I didn't really ask that question great, but I'm curious as to, given that you worked at a place that tried to mix both, how you see it.
And I should, make clear, when I was doing most of my TV appearances those first couple of years, it was when we still had shows like America's Pregame, which was, a completely news-driven show, or, the original Fox Sports Live with Jay and Dan, which was a highlights and news show. Once it started transitioning into, the Colin Cowherd show and Skip Bayless' show, I wasn't really involved with those. But one thing I learned, obviously, going from working at Sports Illustrated most of my career to a TV network for the first time, TV is entertainment. We, as much as it would be from a journalist perspective, wonderful if it was nothing but Outside the Lines and SportsCenter and whatnot all day long. Like, they have to show what they think is most entertaining to the viewers and will get the ratings. And so, given the success of First Take, I think there was a lot of people thinking this is what's driving entertainment now. This is what people want to watch, and maybe it is. My concern at this point would be how much is too much, because now FS1's entire daytime lineup is kind of First Take knockoff after First Take knockoff after First Take knockoff, and ESPN starting to go more and more in that way as well. Like, how much is too much? And I don't know the answer to that. I'm not a TV executive. I'd like to think there's still a lot of room for, bringing on people who cover the sport and connected in the sport. When I was first there, you could at any given time turn on the channel and get Jay Glazer, Peter Schrager, JP Morosi, Ken Rosenthal, Bruce Feldman, myself. I would like to think there's still a lot of room for that as well, and that the TV networks will eventually strike the right balance.
All right. I think we've covered pretty much everything I wanted to do on Fox and The Athletic. Here is the last thing I wanted to ask you about, and it's my segue to Seth. So you're helping me out here, Stu, produce this podcast. and that is this. You don't do this a lot, but Seth does it a ton, and I'm going to talk about it with him. And I want to get your take on how you view sports media people discussing politics on social media, particularly Twitter. And in Seth's case, which I think presents a very, very interesting case study, his father is Lanny Davis. He's been very upfront about how he stands politically, very much sort of a Democratic Party person institutionally, just given who his dad is. And he makes no qualms about putting political opinions out on Twitter. That's an interesting place to be, given that he now works for a place that has to get people to subscribe to him. So the theory, I guess, would be if you're apolitical, the Jordan everybody buys shoes theory, that's how you get the most people to potentially buy your product. There's other theories, obviously. One I subscribe to, you got to be a citizen first. Hopefully people can respect your transparency no matter how you feel. But you're not somebody who's nearly as political on Twitter as Seth. So I wonder how you see sports media people discussing politics on Twitter, because it's something I'm going to get into with Seth, because he may be the most prominent, if he's not, he's among the most prominent sports media people who discuss politics on essentially a daily basis on his social media feed.
Well, I'll let Seth speak for his own philosophy on that. I don't have a particular policy or philosophy. I waded in a little bit right after the inauguration when the travel ban was announced, because I just could not have disagreed with obviously that anymore, and it felt very personal. I know people who would have been affected by that, and so it was an emotional, visceral reaction. There wasn't like any strategy behind it. It was just, that's how I felt at the time when I tweeted it. And I got a lot of backlash, not surprisingly. But the thing I learned in there that I guess it just really hadn't occurred to me is, there are a lot of people who follow me on Twitter who maybe don't even read my articles. They just, my Twitter feed has become part of their daily recreation, their break from work, if you will. And that was a comment I got a few times that I said, it was not so much stick, as much as we kind of make fun of that stick to sports phrase, what they said was, I look to your Twitter feed as, a break from all this stuff. I'm getting the Paul Thing, getting all this stuff from any other place, all these other places, I look to you as my, you know, relief from that. And I want to hear you talk about college football. So that was interesting to hear. I'm not saying I would never tweet about politics or frankly anything, because it's my own personal Twitter account. It's not owned by The Athletic. It was never owned by any of the people that that I worked for. And that's true of all sports writers. You know, it's our own personal accounts. And I don't think anybody's in a position necessarily to say you can or can't do this with your personal account, other than obviously, and I told our staff this when we met in Dallas, don't embarrass the company. Beyond that, like I told them, if you feel strongly about something, I'm not going to tell you not to tweet it. You know, that's each individual person's choice.
All right, last one. Who's the most talented college football team this year, at least on paper, and why?
The most talented college football team?
Yeah, yeah. Not necessarily who you think is going to win the title, but who has the most NFL talent?
I mean, Alabama and Ohio State have separated themselves in that regard. They recruit at a different level than everybody else. They turn out players to the NFL at a level unlike anybody else. Obviously, Michigan had a lot of guys last year. Florida State does a good job. But, you know, I feel like Alabama and Ohio State, you know, they're 1-2 this year, and as long as their current coaches are in place, they're going to at least go into the season 1-2 every year. But that doesn't mean that a Clemson, who also recruits at a very high level, can't, you know, have a season like they did last year when they had a very special quarterback and beat Alabama in the national championship game. Ohio State got shut out by Clemson in the playoff game last year. But if you're just talking about 1 through 85, you know, I think those two are the standard bearers right now.
Stuart Mandel is the editor-in-chief of The All-American. That is The Athletic's premium subscription college football site. He gave you sort of the background as to what they're going to do. I believe, Stu, am I correct, you basically go on any city side of The Athletic and sign up for this, or do you actually have a landing page for the college football site?
The landing page is theathletic.com/All-American. You
okay.
know, that's the front page of our college football platform, and you can subscribe through there, and you can also follow the official Twitter account, which is The Athletic CFB, as in college football. But once you sign up, you know, if you sign up for the All-American, that means you now have access to all of those city sites, Ken Rosenthal, and Seth when his site goes live next month.
All right, good sales job there. Stuart Mandel, of course, former senior writer at Fox Sports and Sports Illustrated. Stu, I honestly wish you luck with this venture. I'm not unbiased here. I really want this to succeed because I think long-term it helps all of us if it succeeds. So I wish you the best of luck, and thank you very much for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thank you, Richard. We're glad to have your support, and it's always good to hear people in the business say that they're rooting for us, and we hope to make it worth your while.
Okay, my thanks to Stuart Mandel. And before we get to Seth Davis, the biggest thing to happen to Barbasol since shaving cream is also the only thing to happen to Barbasol since shaving cream. Introducing new Barbasol razors, the brand America trusts for a close, comfortable shave. It now has premium disposable razors. Barbasol's close shave technology on every razor means you get an advanced pivoting head and ultra-thin open-flow blades. The Ultra 6 Plus razor also features a seventh blade specifically designed to refine and style tricky areas like under the nose, sideburns, and beard. Visit Barbasol.com and get a $2 savings coupon and see for yourself why Barbasol razors are the number one new disposable razors out there. You're looking good, America. You're shaving with Barbasol. All right, and now we bring in Seth Davis. He is the managing editor of The Fieldhouse, which, like Stuart Mandel, part of The Athletic. This is a premium subscription for college basketball. Seth Davis, of course, is a college basketball analyst for CBS Sports, and he joins us now on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Seth, it sounds like you're in a car, Seth. Are you driving somewhere in, where are you? I know you're a big college basketball guy. Are you driving on and the Triangle in North Carolina? Are you in near Pauley Pavilion at UCLA? Where are you right now?
I am actually kind of near Pauley Pavilion at UCLA. I am on, well, you know, as a Californian, you know, we refer to the highways as the 10. It's not Interstate 10, or I-10, it's the 10. So I'm on the 10 right now, headed to meet some friends in Santa Monica. We got a big bar mitzvah this weekend, Richard, so the back of the road will have to wait for the bar mitzvah to be finished.
All right, I appreciate the Seth Davis travelogue there. Thank you very much. All right, before we get to the field house, because I just did a lot of time with Mandel on The Athletic, this is where I want to start with you on, and then we'll get to what you're doing there. Because obviously, I don't follow every sports media person on Twitter, but there are certainly not many national sports media people whose Twitter feed is as politically centric as yours. You are very transparent about the fact that you come from a political family. Your father is Lanny Davis. I think people who follow politics are aware of who he is and his connection to the Clinton administration. You, I think, Seth, are unapologetically part of the Democratic Party. And so what is really interesting to me is we're in this moment in time where sports writers have decided to be far more politically oriented on their social media feeds, and it's twofold. You do risk, obviously, losing potential readers because they don't either agree with you politically or they don't like the fact that you're being political. And also, you probably put yourself into a place of content where I think people don't traditionally think that you should be there. So I'm not really asking you for a philosophy, Seth, but I wonder just when did you decide that you were going to be address politics and issues of and social issues on your Twitter feed, no matter and regardless of what that meant?
Well, there's certainly a no matter or a regardless in there. I mean, I'm very cognizant, first and foremost, of, you know, that I work for, you know, what many large media organizations at the time, Sports Illustrated and certainly currently CBS Sports. And, you know, I'm very lucky that none of my bosses have, you know, asked me not to do this. If they did ask me not to do it, I wouldn't do it. I'm very honest about that. You mentioned about how, you know, it seems that, you know, sports writers and sports media people are becoming more political on their Twitter feeds. And I realize that this is a sports media podcast, but I would submit that everybody has become more political on their Twitter feeds. And that leads me to answer the other part of your question as to when I decided to do this. And it was, of course, during the presidential election. I still maintain, and yes, I am a proud liberal Democrat. I like to think of myself as reasonable and open-minded and open to facts and details and information to constantly challenge my point of views. I believe I'm not rigid in my thinking, and I'd like to think that I'm civil when debating these things. I always have tried to be that, Richard, and I get that most of all from my dad, more so than his ideology, but I still maintain that what I am tweeting about is not politics. The things that we are discussing right now, I mean, we're literally relitigating the Civil War in 2017. That to me isn't politics. And I've never been one over the last 8 years to, you know, maintain, as I think too many Democrats and progressives have done, that, you know, if you were opposed to Obama, then that meant that you were racist. I think that's too easy and too convenient and not particularly fair. So I don't consider, frankly, many of the things that Donald Trump is doing to be within the realm of normal, you know, conservative Republicanism. So I try to keep it on a higher plane. I know that I fail most of the time. I know that way too often I tweet in anger as opposed to reason and civility. And, you know, I get all of that. But it happened very organically with me, Richard, during the campaign. The things that were being done by the Trump campaign to stir up some argument that I thought had been long ago settled, you know, inspired me to kind of move into that direction. And then I saw that a lot of other people were doing it. And then, if you recall, I wrote a Facebook post kind of explaining what I was doing and why. And, you know, I actually think, I'm sure there are people who disagree, but I actually think that I do have a level of expertise here. I grew up in a political family. I'm a lifelong political junkie. I kind of know what I'm talking about, and I would like to think that I do. And so I try to use, you know, my perspective and my expertise and my point of view and hopefully do it in a way that, isn't too hurtful to other people, nor particularly destructive to my career, which is obviously very important to me.
All right, a couple things there. That's interesting. And I think Seth and I are probably obviously closer politically in line than not. We certainly do not agree on everything, at least from what I followed him on his feed. But we're certainly more closely politically aligned than not. So I just say that for full transparency. If you follow me on Twitter, you already know that. Seth, what is interesting, though, to me, at least in this, and this is something too, I don't nearly get into back and forth political discussion as you do. I certainly make my point known about Donald Trump and the Trump administration, particularly I think from a place of having watched Trump for 30 years in New York and thinking a lot of people are getting conned on this. But when I do sort of get into that space, I do wonder, like, I'm not going to change, but I do. There is a calculus that, like, what I am tweeting potentially can limit my audience, and ultimately, I'm employed by Sports Illustrated because people are reading me. This leads to The Athletic, Seth, in that, you know, you're no longer at Sports Illustrated. You're now at a place that really has to drive subscriptions and has to get people to pay money out of their pocket for what you're doing. Does the calculus ever enter that, Seth, in that, you know, if you decided to really be apolitical, logic would state that you'd have a chance of getting everybody or more people under your tent? I know you're not going to do that because it's not how you're built, but I wonder if you've just thought about that calculus at all.
Not really. I mean, people have asked me over Twitter, is there going to be any politics on the site? And the answer is no. This is a college basketball platform. When you're watching a game on CBS and you come to halftime and see me in the studio, I'm not talking about politics, much as I might like to from time to time, depending on what's happening that day. So, it's interesting. You know, I don't track this that closely, but I really haven't lost many followers. Maybe some here and there, maybe a couple of thousand. But, basically, I think people – I don't think what I'm doing on Twitter is really all that unusual. If you look around social media and look around the Twitter sphere, everybody is talking about politics and what's happening. And I think that's a good thing. I think that what's happening with this president in this last election cycle, I think a lot of people are kind of wondering, how did we get here? And I think a lot of people who maybe took some things for granted are no longer doing so. I think, frankly, there was a lot of complacency and just a lot of assumptions that Hillary was going to win. I certainly, I don't know that I assumed it, but I certainly believed it. So, I think it's good that people are engaged. And I think people say, hey, here's the Twitter feed. If you don't like what you see from me on Twitter, you can unfollow, you can ignore my political tweets. But, when we launch the Fieldhouse on October 1st, there's not going to be any politics. Now does that, intersect in the, if there's a social issue, maybe, but it's not a political site. It's a college basketball site. And I don't think someone who's passionate about college basketball wants that content. I just don't see that there's going to be that many people who are not going to pay for that content if they otherwise would have, because they think that, and by the way, if they're complaining that I'm too political on my Twitter feed, what they're really complaining is that I'm too liberal on my Twitter feed, because people who agree with my politics tend not to complain that I tweet about politics. It's just how it works.
All right, here's the last one, and this is an SI thing, and then we'll move on to The Athletic.
Sure.
Obviously, we've known each other a long time. I have great respect for your work. It sucked to hear that, you're no longer at SI. Obviously, I think most people know I'm not management. I don't make those decisions. If I was management, there'd be a lot of things different about Sports Illustrated. That's not the case. But I do want to, I think, just clear up, because I did see when you were laid off from Sports Illustrated that there were people who believed that that happened because you were being political on Twitter, and like there was this notion that that will show other sports media people not to discuss politics. You want to at least clear that part up, because it's an absolute fallacy.
Well, yeah, there was a little bit of that, or people wondering. I did get asked about that. I would venture to guess that 95 to 98% of the people who threw that out on Twitter disagree with my politics.
Right.
So, that's just the nature of the beast. you know, it's not like I'm the only person who's been laid off from Sports Illustrated in the last 10 years. So,
yeah. It's going to happen. I mean, I don't have rose colored glasses. It's going to happen to all of us, including me.
Right. Right. It's just, you know, it's a challenging time for the industry. And that's why, what's happening with The Athletic is so exciting. I mean, we are really getting, I mean, I've seen it from you and so many other people, like even competitors of ours, just people, you know, openly rooting for us. And I think that, you know, consumers are openly rooting for us. So, it had absolutely nothing to do with either the fact that I was tweeting about politics or my political viewpoint. It just came down to numbers and, it was my turn to put my head on the guillotine, but 22 years is a pretty darn good run at a place that I still hold as the gold standard in journalism. And every decision that I make at The Athletic is going to be with the Sports Illustrated impact, influence, and tradition in mind to try to live up to the standard that Sports Illustrated has set over the last six decades.
Okay, let's talk about the field house. One of the interesting things now in your position is you now get to go out and hire staff. So correct me if I don't have everybody, but from working off the top of my head, you've hired Dana O'Neill, you've hired Brian Hamilton, you've hired, I'm probably going to mispronounce his name, Sam Vecenie?
Vecenie, yes.
Okay, yes. And am I missing anyone?
That's it so far for full-time hires. I think we're going to add another name or two in the coming days, both as full timers and as special contributors. I plan to utilize a long list of freelance writers, people who we can either pay a flat rate or pay per article. A big part of it for me right now, which is I honestly don't know what we're doing in terms of the full scope of our content. So. Certainly a lot of people have reached out to me and I've tried to stay in touch with everybody, say, hey, please stay on me. I just don't know yet, but I certainly want to engage and activate. There's a lot of really eager and talented and, experienced, some less so, but still very talented writers who are anxious to cover college basketball, and deliver the kind of coverage to a sport, which if you think about it, Richard, has really kind of been on the front lines of all of these layoffs across the industry. I mean, the NFL is still king. You know, even with all of ESPN's layoffs, they still gave a ton of money to Woj because the NBA still has a lot of cachet.
Right.
It's almost like college basketball was the first one on the other side of that line.
I agree.
So if you look around at these other companies, they're really not as committed as they used to be to covering college basketball. So I have the best of both worlds. I have all these available writers out there who are ready to work. And the competition is really not as formidable as it might have been even a year ago. So we're very excited to go ahead and do this.
One of the things that Mandel talked about was that he saw college football, and understandably so, especially during the season, as a seven-day-a-week enterprise. It was his thought process that you were likely going to get stories 7 days a week, certainly during the season, and that while, there'd be commentary and features, there had to be some kind of breaking news element because that was a way to get publicity for The Athletic. There's for a new place like yours, it's incredibly valuable to have The Athletic on the bottom line of ESPN's feeds because it's just free promotion on that. Have you thought about yet what you want like that editorial mix to be between features, commentary, breaking news, podcasts, etc.?
All of the above. I don't know, I still have a lot to learn. The great thing about working for a digital company, and especially, I mean, this is a Silicon Valley startup, so it's just a different animal than I'm used to, being in Midtown Manhattan with Time Inc. and even, with CBS. Everything is measurable. So if we do something and it works and a lot and people read it and subscribe because of it, we can do more of it. One of the things that I've been very pleased to hear is that the things that really have the greatest impact over at The Athletic are great long-form stories. And everybody's saying, oh, everyone's attention span is so short and everyone's got to pivot to video and all that. No, it's actually the meatier, longer magazine-type stories that do have the most impact. So, yeah, I want to be in the breaking news business. But, Richard, if you look at my career in college basketball, I've never really necessarily been that guy to really break a ton of stories. I mean, I've gotten a few over the years, but I'll be honest, it's a scary place to be. I've had stories that I had it or thought that I had it, but because I wasn't 100%, and most of the times you're not 100%, so I know you can get, 50 scoops and have it be correct, but if you get one wrong, you're going to be remembered for that for a long time. So I have a lot of respect for, you know, the Jeff Goodmans of the world and, you know, Gary Parrish over at CBS. I mean, these guys break a lot of news, and I'm sure a lot of times, you know, they have to make a decision, like, do I really have this story? So to the extent that we can break news at the Fieldhouse, I want to be able to do that, but I also see ourselves more as, you know, news explainers, where sometimes someone else might get the first scoop, but then we kind of come in and give you your TikTok and give you your analysis and, you know, your context that gives you a deeper presentation. So we're going to try to do a little bit of everything.
When is the – do you have a launch date yet, a specific launch date?
Yes, October the 1st.
October the 1st. Okay. And basically it's the same as do you have to – I probably should have asked Mandel this. I don't remember if I did. But obviously, if you sign up for the city sites, you get the Fieldhouse and you get the All-American with that. Do you get can you do the reverse? Like, let's say if you wanted just the Fieldhouse, would you then have to sign up for a specific city? Do you know how it works on the national end?
I wish I knew specifically the answer to this. I was just on a call yesterday with Alex Mather, our CEO. I think that's an evolving equation for them.
Right.
But I think, you know, I almost hesitate to answer because I don't want to be wrong. But I think if we're not at the place, we're moving to the place where you basically have one rate and
gotcha.
You get everything at the Athletic.
Okay.
And then basically you can determine what you want on your feed. I would really recommend to people, you know, obviously, you know, I'm shilling here. The app for the Athletic is unbelievable, and the presentation and the flow and the beauty of these stories. So if you're, you know, a Cleveland fan and you like Cleveland and you like football and Fieldhouse and whatever, you kind of pick what you want in your feed, and then it goes through. So I think they're moving to the point where it's going to be, you know, one rate and you get everything at the Athletic, but I could be wrong, and I know that's kind of an evolving decision-making process.
All right, a couple more here. One of the things I talked about with Mandel, because he got criticized for this on Twitter, and quite frankly, rightly so, and that was about people of color working for the site. His site right now does not have a full-time writer of color. Can you give me your philosophy in terms of making sure that the site isn't just what we have traditionally seen in sports media, which is generally speaking white males? Now, you have a full-time woman writer, obviously, in Dana O'Neill, but what is your philosophy on that, given that there's a lot of talent out there to choose from, at least talent of color?
Yeah, my philosophy is I'm very committed to having a diverse writing staff, and I would only ask people to, you know, give me a little bit of time, you know, and see the decisions that we make moving forward. I think it's very, very important that we're not just talking to people that we know. And it's not even about checking boxes as it is. We want to make sure we're hiring the best people. But we tend to be in our comfort zones. And the first thing we do is talk to people that we know. And that's not a good habit to be in. So I'm very committed to having a diverse writing staff. And so I would just say, give me some time and let me demonstrate my commitment, and I ask everybody to hold my feet to the fire just like I would hold anyone else's feet to the fire on that. I think it's an exceptionally important thing to continually to discuss and make sure that we're doing all right. Because at the end of the day, Richard, I want what's best for the readers. And that is what's best for the readers, is that we have all, you know, perspectives and life experiences represented. So I'm very, very much committed to that.
Seth, have you gotten any either, how do I sort of phrase this? Have you gotten some kind of charter from your immediate bosses as well as the founders of this? Like, what is a reasonable time frame for this to have to work? Like, do you have, I'm throwing this out, it's totally arbitrary. Do you have like 30 months to make this work as a success and to make a little money? Do you have 36 months? Do you have 24 months? Do you, independent of what your contract is, do you have some kind of sense as to like, this thing has to really be a little bit of a success at this time for this to succeed long term?
Well, I honestly don't know the answer to that. What I can tell you is Alex and Adam are our co-founders, and you know, Alex, I talked to a little bit more. You know, he's always cautioning me, like, hey, let's focus on the long term. Like, they're not saying, hey, we need to have this number by January or we're toast. I think they feel very good. They just did a recent round of fundraising that's been documented. They feel very good about where they are and what they have and the amount of runway they have. But listen, this is a Silicon Valley startup. And I'm telling you, man, these guys are wired differently than people that you and I are accustomed to. I mean, they're used to dealing with short-term runway and you know, building runway as they go. So it doesn't sound like to me like they're panicking at all. Or putting any kind of pressure on me. If anything, I'm coming to them with these big plans. I want to go bigger, faster, sooner. And they're telling me, hey, you know, slow down. You're scaring us. We want to make sure that, you know, every story is edited properly and that all the servers and the engineering and the tech and everything can handle it. Like, hire good people. Let's produce good work. Let's take it slow. Let's build it slowly. And they have a proven track record. And I can only tell you that, you know, and that's very, very, very early. But the early signs on this are very positive as far as the amount of subscribers that we're getting for the growth that's only now just taking place.
This is something I asked Stu about, and I want to get your take on it because it's a philosophical question as well. One of the things that has been just historically this is where, and he sort of hit on this, we could have done a whole podcast on this, but the sports media business and the news business as a whole obviously really screwed up in that. Whenever it was, 20, 25 years ago, they made a decision to make content free as opposed to charging it, where you could sort of educate the public on the importance of journalism and the importance of news to the point where they'd have to pay for it. Obviously, the Times has a model and a metered model, and the Washington Post now and Wall Street Journal e-commerce. So some places do it. But as a general rule, sports news has been free and open for a long time. What have you found so far about changing people's behaviors where you can actually get them to go into their wallet to pay money for something that for essentially their lifetime, especially if you're like a 25-year-old, you've gotten all this for free? Because to me, that's like the whole ball game for The Athletic, and I don't know if you'll succeed. Obviously, I'm rooting for you too, but that's like the ball game is, can you in 2017 convince somebody to pay for a product that that other products have always been free? And that's the interesting question to me. Obviously, you have to have quality, you have to have a great user experience, but can you fundamentally, Seth, like change people's philosophy about paying for news?
Well, I think your question is technically accurate, legally accurate, as Bill Clinton once said. but what I would say is it's also a very narrow definition. I mean, you're talking about a certain category of sports media that's been free. But if you look at the whole content ecosystem, much of that is not free.
That's a great point.
Let's start with our cable bill.
Right.
I mean, we pay astronomic money for the cable bill. And I know your kids are too young for this, but I have three boys, 13, 11, and 7.5. I mean, the idea that they're going to pick up a remote control and scroll through a channel guide and pick out, it just doesn't happen. It's not really, yet I'm paying all this money for cable, but we pay for Vudu and we have Hulu and we have Spotify. You know, there's a lot of things that we're paying for. I pay for the Times, I pay for the Washington Post, I pay for the New Yorker, I pay for Sports Illustrated, the magazine. So we're used to paying for content. So all we got to do is give them something worth paying for. I think they'll see that it's just another, and nowadays, listen, it's, From an execution standpoint, like when you go into the Apple store, how easy do they make it for you to spend money, right? I mean, it's like there's a guy right on you, like you swipe your card, you're out of the store, and you don't even know how much you – well, it's the same thing now, you know, with the touch IDs and the apps and this and that. And you, so to give somebody worth paying for, I think they'll pay. And we're not talking about, you know, huge dollars here, but it is incumbent upon me – after, you know, 25 some odd years in the business, you know, I think I know what college basketball fans want. And if I, given the resources and given the support and given the company that I've joined and given the support that I have and the guidance that I have and the access to the data about what's working and what's not and my instincts and my experience, if I can't figure out how to deliver content to passionate college basketball fans in this country that's worth a few bucks a month, then I must not have been paying attention these last 25 years. So we'll see soon enough. But again, super, super, super early, all signs are very positive.
This is the last one for me, Seth. I think this is obviously not going to be an issue because you have people who are really established in the field, particularly you, Dana, and Brian. Have you inquired yet about any kind of credentialing. And again, this is not going to be an issue for your group because, you know, you work for CBS. You're well known as college basketball. Dana, obviously, long, you know, remarkable career at ESPN and the Philly papers and Hamilton, Chicago Tribune and The Athletic. So it's not really an issue for you, but it is interesting to me. Like, have you yet gone about in terms of your organization, like just calling some of the colleges to make sure that they are cool credentialing what has been what is a place that's never published anything yet in specific to the field house? That was something I talked about when Tim Kawakami was on the podcast, and it was interesting to me, and he was totally right about this, that he said that, like, I don't want to come off like an ass here, but I think because it's me and I've covered all these teams for a long time, we're not going to have any issues getting credentialed. If it was somebody else they didn't necessarily know in the market, well, you might have to sort of prove yourself to a, you know, in his case, you know, the Golden State Warriors or the Raiders. So I don't know if you've even looked into this yet, but do you anticipate any issues with, let's say, getting like NCAA tournament credentials? Because obviously that's something that you have to cover given your site.
Yeah, we're not there yet because we haven't launched and the season hasn't started. But, you know, that's not going to be a problem. It's not credentialing that's really the question here, Richard. It's access.
Right.
So, you know, getting to cover a game is one thing. Getting a one-on-one interview with Mike Krzyzewski is another.
Right.
And I'll probably sound like an even bigger ass than Tim sounded like, and I've listened to his podcast, but you know, given my history covering college basketball, I have a lot of relationships that I can call on. And again, I'll go back to my earlier point. It's very interesting to me, Richard. I think you mentioned in this. And one of the first things we did after we kind of announced our staff was we flew Dana, Sam, and Brian out to Las Vegas for this AU tournament. In fact, I was at the game with LeVar Ball and the referee and Zion Williamson and all that circus and talking to coaches around the gym. The earlier point that I made about college basketball being on the front lines of all these layoffs, I was quite surprised and impressed by how many coaches have picked up on that. I mean, like Bill Self saying to me, this is great. We need people to cover our sport. And it's even more so that line of thinking in college basketball than college football. Like, college football is a lot bigger than college basketball, let's be honest. And I think that, you know, even for the most prestigious, you know, college football writers, you know, maybe getting that time with a Jim Harbaugh or an Urban Meyer or whatever, there's just a lot more of them and everything is bigger and it can be a problem. Now, if someone like Stewart, it's going to be less of a problem, but it's still the nature of the beast. College basketball, it's like the perfect storm in that sense. It's a big sport that everybody loves, but it's still kind of a niche and it still has that mentality of, hey, we want to create the conditions that will yield coverage as opposed to saying, hey, how are we going to keep all these people out? So
right. Game
credentialing and all that stuff is going to be easy. You know, access to players, access to coaches that we need might be a little bit more of a challenge, but you know, again, given my history and presence in the business and my relationships, I like our chances of breaking through that.
That's an interesting answer. Seth Davis is the managing editor of The Field House, which will be the premium subscription college basketball site as part of The Athletic. He remains a CBS Sports analyst, and you can see him on that network as well as the CBS Sports Network. Seth, as I told Stu, I'm not biased here. I'm not unbiased here. I'm rooting for you guys. I think it's important for you to succeed because it's important for the business as a whole. Thanks a lot for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, and I am sure I will see you, as they say, around the way. Thanks, Seth.
Yes, you will. Thank you, Richard.
All right, back in the studio, my thanks to Stu Mandel and Seth Davis, both from The Athletic, obviously, for coming on the podcast and discussing that venture. Like I said, I really do hope it succeeds. It would be a pretty big statement for the profession. And then what I would hope is, if it does, obviously other startups come up and have seed money to for people to work in the profession, you know, work a decent living wage and live somewhere and pay their bills, et cetera. So we wish them the best of luck. Previous podcast prior to Stu and Seth, ESPN's Cassidy Hubberth. Very, very popular podcast, Lou. Surprising. I did not expect that. That was part of a sports media roundtable with Jimmy Traina and Chad Finn as well. It certainly wasn't Finn and Traina, so thank you, Cassidy Hubberth. Mitch Album of the Detroit Free Press talking about writing about the piece he wrote on his 7-year-old daughter, Chica, who he and his wife brought from the United States from Haiti. She was diagnosed with a brain tumor and died, and basically we did a whole podcast on how do you write about someone you love who has passed away. Tim Kawakami of The Athletic, Matt Yaloff of the MLB Network, Tom Rinaldi of ESPN, and Ian Eagle of CBS Sports. Those were the last couple of podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. Please go on Apple Podcasts, give us a rating and a review if you like this. That's how the podcast continues. For everybody at Sports Illustrated and Cadence 13, for my producer Lou Pellegrino, we'll see you next time on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.